America. So this is Tracy Wilson. I'm speaking with Neil Rosenberg by phone on July 13th, 2007. This is head of the Campus Folk Song Oral History Project. And I'm in Illinois, in Newfoundland. So, I don't know, my first question is very broad, but it's how did you become interested in traditional music?
Beg pardon?
How did you become interested in traditional music?
Oh, I got interested in folk music back in the early 1950s,
mm-hmm.
When I was a teenager and living in Berkeley, California.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of different influences at the time. I was playing, I had friends who were playing and relatives who were interested in it, and it was, you know, it was a popular new music at that time.
Mm-hmm. I see. And how did you become involved with the Campus Folk Song Club at Illinois?
Well, I was, by 19, in, I went to college in Oberlin, Ohio, at Oberlin
uh-huh.
College, and was involved in folk music there and decided to do a graduate study in folklore, and I went to Indiana University.
Right.
And I started there in 1961, and it was at that time, around that time, that I got to know, first of all, Judy McCullough. She was a fellow graduate student, and then not long after that, maybe a year after that, she went to Illinois, and at some point there, I met Archie Green. I've been trying to remember how I got to know Archie, but I can't remember now. There was a close connection, though, you know, between Urbana and between Illinois and Indiana, and Archie came over probably for some sort of a folklore event, and we met, and then Judy was involved with the Archives of Traditional Music, and also, though, we started a folk song club in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And
At Indiana, mm-hmm.
That's right. And I was the chair of the committee involved with outside other groups, outside
mm-hmm.
groups. And I, of course, got to talking with, I was just looking through my files. I found I have notes of a phone conversation with John Schmidt, who was the president of the club
mm-hmm.
In the fall of 1962. And he gave me a list of forthcoming concerts, and we talked about having a exchange concert, and we published that list in our newsletter, and then I got a letter in November
mm-hmm.
From Vic Lucas,
mm-hmm.
who was my counterpart with the Illinois Folk Song Club, and Vic and I arranged exchange concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got to know the club and some of the people in the club there.
Mm-hmm.
We gave a concert at Urbana on the 12th or 13th of 19, January 63. I can't quite figure out which date. I have
mm-hmm.
Which we, being our bluegrass band at the time, Pigeon Hill Boys, and Greg Hildebrand and Joe Hickerson.
Hmm.
And then the following month, the group came over from Illinois and gave a concert at Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure the names. Well, one of the names was the bluegrass band. The,
mm-hmm.
What do you call them? The Yankee Ridge Runners, and also Doyle Moore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of the other people, but, you know, there was a review of it in the IU Folk Song Club newsletter.
Mm-hmm. I see.
You know, so that was the start of it. And at that time, I was just looking in my notes again. Archie sent me a photostat of a letter he wrote to our guitar player's father. Our guitar player was a fellow family, Main Smith, M-A-Y, Smith, and his father was a well-known scholar and head of the English department at Berkeley. His name was Henry Nash Smith, and Archie sent a letter to Henry talking about Main give a talk as part of the concert on bluegrass music, and then there was a review in the student newspaper on the 15th of January of by Fritz Plow. And Archie sent those things to Maine's father Henry and sent me a copy. So those are the early documents I have, you know, at that point in time.
I see. So that was in 1962.
63.
Okay.
January 1963.
Okay. I see.
Yeah.
So were you one of the first folklore students at Indiana then, or were there already some?
Well, folklore had been going at Indiana since the 1940s. Folklore program started in Indiana with
Stiff Thompson. Yeah.
And then by the time I arrived, they already had a PhD program.
Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of students at that time? I also went to Indiana, so I'm just curious.
There were a fair number of students. Mm-hmm. You know, I Dorson had become the head of the program in 1957, and you know, he'd been aggressively getting new students to come, and so there was a fair number of students.
Interesting. Let's see. Well, my next question might be, these questions I guess I wrote more geared for people here who are students on campus, and I've tried to modify them a little bit, but I'll go ahead and ask you this one. Maybe you have some insight, or maybe you could talk about the role that the IU counterpart had on that campus. But my question is, what role did the club play on campus at the U of I, or maybe in your case at Indiana?
I think that from the point of view of how things worked at Illinois, the fact that Archie was there made a very big difference.
Right.
And he worked, I noticed in our correspondence that when he came back, you know, he left in 1965 and went and did a PhD at Penn and came back in 67.
Mm-hmm.
And we corresponded about putting together, a cooperative schedule and booked people like Jimmy Tarleton. So Illinois, because of Archie's contacts and knowledge of what was going on in the world of research, a lot of interesting performers were brought to campus there, and some of them came to Indiana too. Glenn Orland is another one.
Right. I just interviewed him last week, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had a very active club. Now, I wrote a little essay about the club that was published in that book that the guy Ron Cohen did. We had a conference. I'm just seeing if I have that in front of me. Yeah, it's a little book called Wasn't That a Time? First Hand Counts of the Folk Music Revival by Ron Cohen. Anyway, I wrote about that then. You know, the club started in 62. Mm-hmm. It was the most active club on campus. This is the Indiana club. In 63, 64, and then by 65 it was starting to lose steam because younger students were more interested in the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things changed as far as interest in music was concerned. So it sort of, you know, was very popular, and then it kind of went downhill.
And so are you talking about Indiana now, or Illinois?
I think things were a little different in Illinois because Archie was there and had, you know, had enthusiastic followers and brought interesting stuff to campus.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a band that played there in 68 in Illinois called ourselves the Friends of Greasy Green.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it was February 68. So, I think that activity, you know, kind of died out when Archie left there in Illinois. But at Indiana by 67, it had pretty much ended.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
One other thing I should say is that in Indiana, the folklore, some folklore students interested in music played an important role in the club, but there was virtually no encouragement or interest on the part of the faculty.
Mm.
Dorson was very much opposed to the whole idea of popularization.
Interesting. Yeah, Judy McCullough talked to me a little bit about that, but yeah, that definitely sounds familiar. So there were students in the folklore program who had interest, but the faculty kind of discouraged it, it sounds like.
Yeah, they in the course of, in the case of Dorson, discouraged it. The others just paid no attention to it.
Hmm. And is that because they didn't have an interest in music in general, or just that they didn't approve of this sort of popularizing force?
Oh, I think a combination of those things.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was a student thing.
Yeah.
And I think understandable in terms of just the dynamics of the relationships between students and faculty.
Mm-hmm.
There were also folklore students who didn't really have any interest or knowledge in the folk song Bible.
Right. And I don't know when exactly the ethnomusicology component came along at IU, but were there people who studied music, maybe in the music school, who did have an interest, or was that considered something completely different from class?
Well, George List was teaching ethnomusicology there, and I took courses from him, and then in 1962, Alan Merriam arrived, so there was definitely the possibility of doing ethnomusicology courses.
But that might not have included a sort of folk revival stuff in their minds. I don't know.
Oh, no. First of all, there was nobody in the School of Music that I knew that was at all interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
To give you one example, I was working in 1963 as the manager for Bill Monroe's Country Music Park in East Boston, Indiana.
Right.
And I wanted to do a paper on my experiences in this for Merriam, and he wouldn't allow me to do that. He said that's too close to home. You know, if you're interested in, you know, professionalism in music, you should study the professional musicians of Africa. You know,
mm-hmm.
He gave me a pile of books in French to do my paper for him and that. So. There was no, ethnomusicology today is much more interested in looking at home culture.
Right.
But it wasn't then.
Mm-hmm. Do you know when that shift happened? Or does it a gradual thing?
Ethnomusicology?
Yeah.
I really can't tell you. I guess, it's happened in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know the history of the discipline well enough to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just curious. Another question I have is, did the political climate of the 1960s have an impact on how people who were interested in folk music perceived themselves?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that a majority of the people that I knew were not so interested in the political dimensions of the revival, and were more interested in what was happening that was of interest to us, and you see this in the bookings and in what Archie did, we were interested in traditional performers, people who'd grown up with the music and who'd been involved in recording for Hillbilly or Blues or, you know, that sort of thing, or who came out of the traditional background themselves. So we weren't very interested in the political or the singer-songwriter aspects of the music. And in fact, when the SDS started, well, some of us got involved in, you know, helping with the political activism that grew up starting in the early Vietnam era, you know, 64, 65 in there.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, there was overlap, but it was not a strong threat.
Mm-hmm.
There are some exceptions. This guy Greg Hildebrand that came over and gave a concert at Illinois from Indiana, wrote protest songs and was was known for that. And there were others as well, but
mm-hmm.
generally speaking, the politics aspect wasn't very, very strong when the club was at its greatest.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, this has been the kind of question that I get such a range of responses to, because there are so many people who say, no, it didn't have anything to do with
yeah.
politics. And then other people who I think maybe have a broader definition of what political can include say, oh, yes, we were the proto-civil rights movement or things
yeah.
like that, just because of their interest in blues or, you know, in I guess, other ethnic groups. They see that as sort of a political act
yeah.
in itself. So it depends, yeah.
Well, we're all aware of the political struggles of the time, but it's
mm-hmm.
just that within the context of the Folk Song Club, my experience in Indiana, and I can't say for sure
mm-hmm.
about Illinois, but my experience in Indiana was that it was another sphere, and they overlapped, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't the same.
Right, I see. How would you describe the impact that your involvement in the club, and this could be either at Indiana or Illinois, I guess, had on you then and later in life?
Well, you know, I was already very much involved in all of this before and continued on right down to the present, so it was just part of, and I've been involved as well in the Folk Song Club at Indiana, you know, at Oberlin College.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was president of the club there, you know, before I came.
So there was a club there as well.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that club was in existence when I arrived in 1957, and it had been started by Joe Hickerson, who went from Oberlin to Indiana and was one of the founders of the Indiana Club. So there was a lot of connections that way.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was an ongoing thing, you know. And I would just say that by the end of my... actually, in the middle of all of this, I left the Folk Song Club executive in 1963 because I became involved in my work at Bean Blossom for Monroe,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have time to do that, so my interest moved in that direction into bluegrass
mm-hmm.
and into that sort of thing, a little more focused in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
The whole business of running events
mm-hmm.
and booking people and all that sort of thing, you know, that was part of my education that has, you know, shaped my perception of life in music.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the best I can do for you.
Mm-hmm. I see. So it sounds like you shifted from being involved with the club at Indiana to more this professional association with bluegrass music and
mm-hmm.
being responsible. Was that something that many people followed, or did you think you were kind of unusual in that sense?
Well, I was kind of the instigator of and the promoter of interest in Bean Blossom and the Brown County Jamboree and,
uh-huh.
and in that context at IU and a lot of people we publicized the events at Bean Blossom, and, you know, got a lot of people to come out from the university, and that had never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of a precursor of when the Bluegrass Festival started
mm-hmm.
there at Bean Blossom in 67. Those festivals still go on.
Mm-hmm.
I was just at the festival last month.
Right, right. I interviewed Judy right before she was about to
yeah.
leave for that. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess, for me, it was just a shift of interest. And not everybody shared that. A lot of people, you know, in the mid-60s, a lot of people went from folk music into rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because all of a sudden rock and roll became okay.
Mm-hmm.
With the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, did you have this interest in bluegrass all along, or was it something that developed being in Indiana, or...?
Started when I came to Oberlin,
mm-hmm.
but when I came to Indiana and, you know, discovered that Del Monroe had this park, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I could hear and meet and play music with, you know, with the top people in that music form.
Mm-hmm.
There, that heightened my interest and involvement.
Mm-hmm. I see. And when did his festival begin? I think
1967.
67. Wow. Okay.
But shows there went on every Sunday from April until October. That had been going since back in the 50s.
Oh, really? Wow. Interesting. One other question. This is, a bit unrelated from the stuff we've been talking about so far, but I'm actually an East European specialist, and one interest I have is in East European communities within the United States, or East European ethnic communities. And so one thing that's intrigued me a bit is a strong interest that many Jewish youth had in the 50s and 60s in folk music. And I was just wondering if you might have any insight into that.
All I can say is that I was surrounded by older relatives who were interested in folk music as a popular music.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a lot of Jewish people, at Oberlin and, I guess at IU too. I don't know. It's not an easy one to answer.
Mm-hmm. When you say you had older relatives who were interested in folk music, were they what kinds of folk music was it?
It was the sort of the popular stuff of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Ives, whatever was on the go that was popular in the late 40s and early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The records that were produced by Ash and Folkways Josh White.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff. My folks had Josh White, an album of Josh White, and so on. So, my sense of it is these are, second generation.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish, Eastern European family, but born and raised in the United States, and it was part of the fashionable left wing.
Mm-hmm.
Focus of the 30s and 40s, and part of the fashion.
Mm-hmm.
of that time. And I was just talking with one of my cousins about this. I mean, we didn't hear anything in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
We knew a few Yiddish words, and
mm-hmm.
and we heard lots and lots of dialect jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Told them and so on and so forth, but we didn't sing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, with some of my Jewish friends, Theodore Bekel was very, very popular.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that name?
Theodore Bekel.
I've heard of him. Now I'm not sure where.
It's just amazing to me that people don't know about Theodore Bekel today, because he was a big name. If you go to the Elektra Records discography website, you can see all the records that he made.
Uh-huh.
He's an actor.
Theodore
Bekel. He was in a lot of different movies. Uh-huh. Russians Are Coming, and so on. Anyway.
Did he sing?
Huh?
Did he sing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. He sang Israeli folk songs and Jewish folk songs.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of other things. And he was very, very, very popular.
I wonder where I've heard of him. I'm sure.
B-I-K-E-L.
Okay.
So he was popular, and he was sort of the symbol of, Jewish music. Nobody had ever heard of Klezmer.
Mm, right.
I hadn't, and I didn't hear of it until I was 70.
And so when was he really popular, would you say?
From about 1955 through 1965.
Okay, yeah.
On Elektra Records.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
I don't know if anybody's written about him as a musician, but his... I can tell you that he was really something big.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, it seems like there's more of an interest now. Maybe this was just at the time, there was more of a push to assimilate into mainstream American culture, but it seems like now there's more of an interest in among Jewish musicians in rediscovering their own roots and things than maybe back in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, the interest was in learning this stuff, and it was a way of sort of embracing a American culture, I guess, although it didn't seem like that to me. You know, I didn't grow up in a family that was like, you know, that lit candles on Friday night.
Right.
We did celebrate Passover,
uh-huh.
and I was in the temple youth group, and, you know, stuff like that, but, you know, contemporary Judaism is, you know, not the same as Judaism was then.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, that's all the questions I have. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think is important for people to know?
I think that, you know, one of the things is about these clubs is they're rehearsals for getting involved in various sorts of organizations later in life.
Uh-huh.
You know, you learn how to, that you've got to have a budget, and you've got to be able to negotiate with people, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was a lot of what we ended up doing. Also, there was a strong, in our club in Bloomington,
mm-hmm.
there was a really strong service orientation. We
mm-hmm.
gave workshops and lessons and, you know, attempted to spread the word. And I think that's an important part of it.
Interesting.
We felt that, you know, we need to let people know what was going on. And if people did know, they would be interested and would come around.
Mm-hmm. Did the club at Indiana, was it also very large the way the club here was at one time?
Yeah, it was. In fact, one of the little things that I noticed in the Folk Song Club newsletter in March 63, they said that the University of Illinois concert at Bloomington resulted in 24 new members and 70 admissions and 40 students for instrumental workshops.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, it was one of the biggest clubs on campus
mm-hmm.
at IU in 62 and 64.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into a fight with the administration because they wouldn't let us book Joan Baez to raise some money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the all the stuff is in the newsletter there, but, you know, they didn't like the fact that we were going to try to make money. We were speaking, you know, which was what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
See, one of the ways these clubs worked is that you would try and get somebody who was popular to make some money so that then you could pay for someone that you really wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. I see. So it wasn't her political background that they were concerned about.
Well, the administration was, I think, you know, nervous about her politics, but
mm-hmm.
That was before the Vietnam thing, which is where Joan Baez's name really, you know, got
right
associated with extreme politics.
Uh-huh. I see. Was there any rivalry between the Illinois and Indiana clubs that you were aware of?
No, none. I would say, you know, we were really happy to know they were doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really nice that Archie was over there because he, you know, could. He had contacts and he had great ideas and he was very, you know, he worked very hard to encourage people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know. Is there anything else?
I can't really think of anything else. I mean, it's been a long time.
Right. One theme that I've encountered, because I'm kind of winding down the project as I'm getting ready to leave, is that everyone mentioned how important Archie was to you know, their perceptions of music and cultivating their aesthetics, tastes, and just getting things done, too. So.
Well, I overheard a conversation at Dean Blossom between Tom Adler, who was a student there,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was Dave Samuelson.
Uh-huh.
And they were and Samuelson was talking about running into Roger Ebert.
Oh.
Who was a member of the club.
Right.
And it was interesting to hear these two old guys talking about a mutual member of the club. So there's, you know, kind of a fellowship there that's been a long time.
Yeah, I actually contacted Roger Ebert, and he said that he would write something for our project, but I haven't heard back from him, so we'll see. Yeah. But yeah, but
so what will the project end up having?
Well, it's the focus is that it will be a digital online kind of project where there'll be audio of the interviews that I'm conducting and images, hopefully, from club events. It seems like there haven't been many that have remained. At least every person I interview says they don't really have any photos. So I might have to go with some from the student newspaper here, which the quality is not going to be great because they're just going to be scanned from the papers and stuff like that.
I'm thinking if I have anything, I've got somewhere I have some very bad shots from the Flatt & Scruggs concert.
Oh.
But I do have the poster from the Flatt & Scruggs concert.
Oh.
Which has pride of place in my collection of posters.
Right. I think that there's the newsletter for the CFC here. It was bound, and I think there's copies of that in there, and that's been digitized, I think. So that's good.
So
it's mainly sort of an audio project. I've been taking pictures of the people in our interview in some way. I hope to incorporate that. That was actually one thing I wanted to ask you about is, since I can't, you know, take your picture, if you might be willing to let me use one that's available online, because I need to get permission from, I saw one on the memorial website, but...
Yeah.
If there's another one that's preferable to you, that would be fine as well.
It's okay with me, whatever. There's a couple pictures of me in Bluegrass Odyssey.
Okay.
And, you know, whatever.
I think I came across one that was of you from the 60s playing somewhere. So.
Oh.
But I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there is one on the Bluegrass Boys website.
Yeah, maybe that was it.
Well,
I could do both, so it would be, you know.
Yeah, that picture was taken at Bean Block.
Oh, okay. Wow, great. I'm trying to think. I'm probably going to just go ahead and turn off the recorder right now. And okay. Yeah, I guess it's off. Okay. I don't know. Is there anything else? Any other questions you have? I need to send you the consent form. I'll do that probably within the next hour or two.
Okay.
Fine. And hopefully it'll get here before I leave. I don't know what the mail time from Canada is.
When are you leaving?
The 26th is my last day here at work. But if it comes a little later, I'll probably, you know, someone will have someone take care of it. So.
Okay. Yeah, well, if you're going to send a PDF, are you?
Yeah. Well, it might be a Word, but
okay,
whatever.
Okay, well, I can fill it out and just pop it in the mail.
Yeah.
And these days, it seems to take a couple weeks.
Really? Okay. Oh, wow.
So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking. I appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.